content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we are now in the conception part of this, which is January and February. And we will start with the topic, saying no to deer. During a garden workshop, a visitor commented, as he looked around at the mature shrubs and big swaths of perennials, "You must have a fence, because otherwise this garden wouldn't be here," he said. Because it's mostly hidden in the surrounding woodland tree line, he hadn't spied the fence itself yet, but he just knew it's a deer-free zone. "I'm a serious gardener, and my home is in serious deer country, adjacent to a 5,000-acre state park where groups of four or five animals browse my boundaries daily. And in winter, I have seen 40 at a time just across the road. I had no choice but to fence, but in some circumstances, there are other tactics, from temporary or small barriers, than my 2.3 acres of 8-foot-high wire mesh enclosures, to repellents, to limiting the choice of what you plant. Be aware, these are very adaptive, voracious animals that are not picky when hungry and will at least sample most anything. Their typical diet, referred to as browse, is leaves, buds, and branches of mostly deciduous, but not always, trees. In the growing season, they may focus on green vegetation, but it's often in the downtime when they can do the most lasting damage to woody plants. A hosta will typically grow back after being browsed, a prize specimen shrub that took 10 years to cultivate may not recover. The decision on how to manage against deer must take into account the local population and its patterns, the value of the landscape you wish to protect, how attractive your plant palette is to them, and also local fencing codes. In areas like mine of high pressure, it's unlikely you can gain 100% control except with a major fence. Before I had mine, I tried other measures, including repellents. I didn't understand then that these products are best suited for low or moderate deer pressure areas. Typically, sprays, various brands either smell or taste bad to deer, or both. The most effective ingredients to check labels for are eggs. The sulfur scent of rotten eggs does the job. And capsaicin, the heat in hot peppers. Different brands require different reapplication intervals, as often as every 2 weeks, and are not appropriate for use on edibles. Plus, they can't be applied in the hottest times or coldest, below about 35 degrees Fahrenheit. Besides all the effort, the products are not cheap if you have a large landscape to protect year-round. But perhaps you have fewer deer or a problem in one season only. Maybe certain plants like arborvita or yew are being eaten in winter, repellents may work in that case, or young trees are being damaged by bucks in rut. When males are on the move leading up to breeding season and polishing their antlers by rubbing against trees in fall, it can be very destructive. And sometimes the behavior continues into January. Even in an unfenced property, this kind of damage can be prevented by exclusion, employing the same keep-out tactics as my permanent fence, but in a temporary version. Individual trees or shrubs can be protected with 4 or 5 feet high pens of reusable chicken wire and stakes or even snow fencing, so bucks can't rub them, nor can any deer browse them. Plastic netting could be used to wrap or drape over shrubbery plants. I did this each fall years ago, but I preach a 365-day garden philosophy. To strive to look out the window every day of the year with pleasure. The last thing I want to create is an axial view half the year of imprisoned shrubs and trees. Similarly, I bristle at adhering to a narrow regional list of less palatable to deer plants. Don't fence me in by my plant palate, please. Whole books are devoted to deer-resistant plants, but I didn't do the painful homework to qualify to write them. I got a 365-day fence. There are various kinds to consider. A 5-foot mesh fence might keep a small area protected, such as an average-sized vegetable garden, which might look to the deer like a tight spot it doesn't want to jump into. Speaking of tight spots, in a long-ago trip to the hillside northern California garden of salvia, expert Betsy Klebsch, I learned that two parallel low fences will also work, specifically 2 4-foot fences spaced about 5 feet apart. The gap between is too wide for jumping over and too tight to look inviting, but it's big enough for your wheelbarrow and mower, or you can plant it a garden ringing the garden. This solution is great for small gardens or areas near the house where a tall fence would be unsightly. It creates a space like an old-fashioned dooryard garden, but with 2 rows of fence. Critical tip, no matter how tall your fence is, what you do at ground level to exclude the deer is just as important. Deer are happy to do the limbo anytime and wriggle on it particularly fawns. Following the same too-wide-to-jump area, longtime willow collector and expert plantsman Michael Dodge suggested to me the unexpected possibility of a living fence. He recommends creating dense fedges, fence meets hedge, of the most deer-resistant willows, Salix purpurea, Nana, or Gracilis. Other effective fence designs that cost less are often electrified, though some local ordinances forbid them. Electric fences can be vertical or slanted, and recommended heights vary, including a 7-strand 8-footer for total control, or a 3-foot peanut butter fence that uses foil packets of peanut butter every 3 feet along the upper of its 2 wires to entice deer to investigate and get a buzz. Like the family dog with the invisible fence, they learn to obey it. The Internet Center for Wildlife Damage Management webpage has designs for both of these and other fences, or search for slanted electric deer fence and electric peanut butter deer fence. A final trick, I didn't want to want the wire mesh look along my front boundary, so I invented a hybrid. I have stretches of 4-foot-high pickets punctuated by 8-foot fence posts spaced 8 feet apart. Between the posts and above the pickets, I strung 4 feet of heavy black plastic mesh reinforced with wire, creating an 8-foot fence that looks like a mere white picket fence as you drive by. Well, except apparently to the deer, who have been dared, have never dared make the leap. And our next topic is pruning pared way down. I admit I lack the artistic vision required to turn boxwood into crowing roosters, but I refuse to be held hostage by errant water sprouts or suckers and broken or badly placed branches. I am happy to pay a skilled arborist to do the really challenging work, but basic care and maintenance of shrubs especially mostly involves making a simple set of obvious cuts whenever I see a plant in need of them. By then, also sharpening our powers of observation, we can even learn to answer the worrisome question of when, on which kind of plant, to go beyond those basic cuts should some woody thing need more serious corrective measures. If I can do this much, so can you. The top 3 tips apply to all woody plants, but with conifers, any more involved pruning is a little trickier and requires extra research, first because some, like you, respond to harder pruning than others that are less forgiving. How my everyday as needed routine works. Take out the 3 D's anytime they occur. The D's are dead, damaged, and diseased wood. Some people say there are 5 D's, with dying and deformed being added to the list. But I lump those into my damaged category. Next, take out all suckers and water sprouts as often as required. This means that mess at the base of a grafted plant that looks like a thicket of shoots where the underground rootstock is trying to overtake the desired plant. It also means twigs that shoot straight up vertically off a branch at a 90-degree angle or thereabouts, very common on fruit trees, say, or old magnolias. Look at the architecture of these shoots, which sometimes emanate from the trunk of an aged tree, too. If you left them on, what would they turn into? Nothing very useful or well-engineered. Remove them. The next step is similarly off with the head of anything thinner than a pencil or turning inward. Rubbing against another branch is no good either. Those are probably all in the D called deformed. Again, learn the when by studying new wood and old wood. Some pruning tasks are not do it any time it occurs, like those three, but time to coincide with a specific moment in the particular plant's growth cycle. Ill-timed pruning may eliminate the next flowering or fruiting, or in more extreme situations, may stress the plant and even cause decline. Each May and June, I'm asked, why didn't my lilacs bloom? Only to find out in the next sentence that the questioner had literally nipped the plants in the flower bud with late summer, fall, winter, or earliest springtime pruning. Meaning, sometime after the New Year's blossoms had been set, early bloomers flower on old wood. Go out and look at an apple or peach tree or a forsythia or lilac bush in winter or even early spring. Unless you pruned in summer or fall, you'll see flower buds already in place, dormant but there. If you prune them off, the plant won't flower that year. Make sense? It will not harm the plant to prune extra early, but in most cases, why not enjoy the blooms first? My old apple trees are an exception. Though they may be laden with flower buds, I prune apples and pears and peaches and cherries in late winter, when they are leafless and dormant, and if I time it right, I can force some of those lopped branches into bloom indoors as a bonus. Generally speaking, if you want flowers the next year, don't prune spring blooming shrubs and trees more than a month or so after they finish blooming, because they will be starting to the bud-setting process for next year. This means not pruning, except the three Ds, from late spring or earliest summer, nor any time again until after the next bloom cycle. After they're finished flowering, prune immediately. Woody plants that flower late in the season, such as hydrangea, paniculata, bloom on new wood. Again, go look. You won't see any flower buds that overwintered on the old twigs. Discovering where on the stems and when the plant creates its flower buds will help direct pruning efforts. Sometimes a shrub is just too big, or got beat up in a storm, or is otherwise a mess, and the only hope besides replacement is to attempt rejuvenation pruning, a more extreme version of ongoing removal of damaged parts. The process can be staggered over two or three springs or performed all at once. I've used the staggered approach on old lilacs, at first removing the three Ds plus maybe one-third of the oldest stems down to the base. I may also lower the remaining ones down partway to the junction of a well-placed side root. Meantime, I'm surveying the lower reaches to identify any strong, well-placed younger shoots that could figure into future architecture. The next year, and perhaps a third year too, I repeat the process. The rip off the bandage version is easier, but scarier, and best used on robust, fast-growing shrubs. Essentially, you cut the entire plant to the ground, usually 6 to 12 inches, and let it regrow. When such wholesale rejuvenation is required, I do it in spring to allow the plant to the entire season to recover. Sometimes, selfishly, I wait until after bloom Sometimes I sacrifice bloom in the name of getting the job done now. Some of my oldest shrubs, including several giant physocarpus, opulifolius, nine bark, have been cut to the ground more than once, rising back to major status. I have also employed the brutal approach on weigela, twig willows, and dogwoods, Asperia, Philadelphus, mock orange, and cottonus, smoke bush, and of course, roses. One time I never pruned beyond the three D's in my cold winter zone is in fall. I don't want new growth to possibly sprout and then get hit by blasts of cold before the wood hardens off. Avoid undertaking rejuvenations late in the season and even any reshaping. If I were in a frost-free zone, I might be more flexible. And our next topic is intermediate witch hazels. I lost a lot of shrubs in 2011 between deliberate culling required by the garden's age, at that time about 25 years, and a freakish late October snowstorm that took even more than I'd planned to surrender. One silver lining, or should I say gold and copper, was the spots opened up for some witch hazels or hamamelis. My choices were intermediate hybrids, like orange Gelina and yellow Pallida. Intermediate hybrids or hamamelis intermedia means that each is a child of two great parents, the Chinese witch hazel, hamamelis molis, and Japanese H. japonica. Their offspring, hardy in zones 5 to 8, are mostly fragrant and all bloom early, unfurling little streamer-like petals in a spidery arrangement and boasting hot fall foliage besides. I have said before that if garden centers were open in winter in cold climate zones like mine, early blooming Asian witch hazels would knock the more vulgar and admittedly later forsythia out of the ring. Mine bloom most years in February into March, but I have had them begin before New Year's. Gelina, with coppery scented flowers, is more horizontal in stature than another I made a spot for, the vase-shaped Pallida. I'm figuring on perhaps 10 or 12 feet in eventual height and about a width about as wide someday. Some varieties, like the best known of all, yellow Arnold Promise, are slightly bigger, perhaps 15 by 15 feet. The intermediate witch hazels like a spot in full sun to part shade and more like meaning more flowers, but spare them a hot, dry location. Like Fothergilla and Corylopsis, winter hazel, their cousins in family Hamamelidaceae, and two of my favorite shrubs of all, witch hazels, have handsome foliage that seems to resist most insects and disease. Whether deer eat them or not depends where you live, as with many plants. Rutgers University, in its searchable online database of plants according to their palatability to deer, classifies intermediate witch hazels as seldom severely damaged, other than such sources disagree. My only caveat, keep an eye on the base for the emergence of any suspicious, extra vigorous shoots that may wish to overtake the desired cultivar. These are often sold as grafted shrubs, meaning the rootstock, our Native American witch hazel, Hamamelis virginiana, which blooms in fall along my wooded property line, may try to outcompete the desired variety. Decades ago, my first hybrid witch hazel got engulfed before I understood what was happening. Remember who has the pruners and take no prisoners on suckers. And let's see. We'll start this next topic, but we'll probably have to finish in our next session. Hellebores galore. A strange-shaped box, much longer than wide or tall, arrived unannounced one day. Inside was a plastic plug tray, a seedling flat, but with deeper individual cells than typical, packed with baby hellebores. The surprise gift was from a friend, Charles Price, who was trying his hand at breeding some of the so-called Orientalis hybrids, or Helleborus ex hybridus. I have never grown a hellebore except white-flowered Helleborus niger, the so-called Christmas rose, the first perennial to bloom every year since I acquired it at a local garden center. At the time the seedling arrived, I didn't even know I could grow another hellebore species. Now I also grow the stinking hellebore, H. fetutius, a short-lived and shallow-rooted perennial. We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Dean Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. And we will begin our next program for the week next time and continue Hellebores Galore. And I hope you enjoyed this program. Thank you so much for listening.